In 1811, 500 slaves in southern Louisiana rose up in a rebellion that could have changed history, but instead, very few people today know about this rebellion, and even fewer know the truth behind it. On November 8th and 9th, hundreds of reenactors will retrace the path of the largest slave rebellion in U.S. history. And here to talk with us about it is Dred Scott, an artist who has spent the last 6 years or so working to bring this rebellion alive again. Dred, how are you, man?
I'm doing good. Doing really good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to having you on for a lot more around this, because I'm sure there'll be stuff to talk about after you're done, too, this week. But let's look at this. Very few people know about the rebellion, not to mention the significance of it. So let's start with what it was and why it was and remains so significant.
Yeah. Well, in 1811, in January 8th through 11th in 1811, the largest rebellion of enslaved people in the history of the United States happened. That rebellion didn't happen because one enslaved person got whipped one too many times. It was actually planned for a year or maybe longer, and they had this bold vision to seize all of Orleans territory, which is now modern-day Louisiana, and set up an African republic in the New World. It would have been a sanctuary for Africans and people of African descent, and they would have abolished slavery much the way that was done after the Haitian Revolution. It was the most radical vision of freedom in the United States at the time, and it was also more radical than the French colonial society, which, although they had the Declaration of the Rights of Man, was a slaving empire. And so the significance today is that, you know, here is the largest rebellion of enslaved people, and it had a vision that was going to actually really remake and change U.S. and world history by eliminating enslavement in the locations where they were hoping to seize power. And the other two things that are important about this are that it actually had a chance of success. I mean, all slave revolts are a long shot, but this actually was planned in a way that it could have succeeded. And then the other thing is that's significant is the history of this is buried. It's completely suppressed. It was suppressed starting in day one. The governor kind of spun the story that there wasn't much to see here. And then, you know, when they started doing more scholarship and research into slavery, you know, because the original knowledge was suppressed and said there was nothing significant, a lot of scholars didn't pay that much attention to it. And it really the modern history and modern telling of it only became, you know, more widely known with a sort of some people's historian published a book in 1996.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that got me, and actually I wanted to ask you about this. I was just talking with my friend here, and he was talking about wondering how much Haiti had actually influenced the rebellion in Louisiana.
Yeah. Well, there's several ways which it does, and I will put a disclaimer on this and a lot of other things I might talk about the history. I'm an artist. I'm not a historian. And there are historians that have done work on this, and it needs to have more historic research. I can tell you what I know, and I've studied a lot of history and worked with historians, but, you know, I'm not a historian. So what I do know is that part of why sugar was even being grown in Louisiana was because of the rebellion, the revolution that was successful in Haiti. When the revolution jumped off, a lot of enslavers decided they had to get the hell out of Dodge because the revolution was going to both overthrow their economy but also potentially kill them. And so they fled, and many went to Cuba and many went to Louisiana. And so that was part of the reason why the people that had the desire to grow sugar but also the people with the knowledge of growing and refining sugar, and that was enslaved people, because the enslavers, when they left Haiti, they actually brought the people they enslaved with them. And producing sugar is actually complicated. I mean, the skills necessary to refine it is not something that everybody knows how to do, even back then. And so they needed people with the particular knowledge of doing that to be able to set up more slave labor camps that were plantation agriculture at the time. Another thing is that Haiti was the largest producer of that particular commodity in the world. And after the revolution, the production dropped drastically. They didn't want to be part of the sort of the world economy of sugar production in the same way. And so that sort of meant that there was a gap. I mean, if you're sort of, you know, a capitalist looking to make profit, you're like, okay, this commodity has, we need more of it, and we can grow it elsewhere. And so that led to sort of the sugar being, you know, more grown there. But then when you bring enslaved people with knowledge of this, you know, incredible revolution that happened in Haiti, they also were thinking, well, maybe we should do that here. And so there was an inspirational and aspirational aspect, including possibly that some of the people that were in Haiti might have even participated in the rebellion. And here's where there's a conflict between historians. Some historians say that the leader of the revolt in 1811 in New Orleans, Charles Galland, some say he was born in Haiti, and others say that he was born in Louisiana. And I don't know the difference. I mean, I actually don't know what's true. But it is conceivable that this was a person that was Haitian-born and thus brought some of his knowledge of that revolution with him. There were a couple other factors that go into why the Louisiana and this rebellion, including that the United States had recently purchased Louisiana, as you know, various rising capitalist powers do, and they bought Louisiana from the French, from Napoleon. And part of why that happened was that with the Haitian Revolution, Napoleon didn't want to send, you know, his large admiralty around halfway around the world because there was nothing to defend. And so he, in addition to having war debt from the wars that he was fighting in Europe, he didn't need to have a place to kind of refine some of the sugar and grow crops, so he was willing to let Louisiana go. And so the U.S. was taking over. And so there was various infighting and differences and changes in power that sort of weakened the various ruling classes that were there in Louisiana at the time. And so the enslaved thought that they actually might have a shot at successfully wresting a bit of territory and freedom out of that situation.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that got me is that, and I, you know, the work you've done on this in terms of really digging up the history, which in a lot of ways, I know that I could tell from reading some of the stuff that you put out, there were people who you could go to that knew some of the history, some of them knew more, some of them knew less, but it gave you something to actually work with. And it really was, you know, when you look at this, the important element of actually looking at the actual history of this rebellion, and that it was in fact suppressed. Even the name was erased from history and changed to what? The German Coast Uprising of 1811, which would give you no hint about the significance of this rebellion.
Well, the German Coast Uprising, I mean, it's interesting. So this is sort of development of empire and states and stuff. Many Germans came and settled in that region, the region where this rebellion took place, in part of Louisiana. And at the time, it was a Spanish colony, that region. And so the Spanish sort of said, y'all can live there. And then most of the Germans left or died out. There were still some there in 1811. But largely with the you know, importation of Africans, and, you know, it had become a sort of a coast that had, you know, slave labor camps and had enslaved a lot of people who were principally African. And so, you know, it might be better to call it the African Coast Uprising, but the main thing is it's become known as the German Coast because Germans were settled there in the, I believe, late 16 and early 1700s. But then, you know, it just doesn't even get, even if you call it the African Coast Uprising, it doesn't really get at the majesty and significance of what this is. I mean, other rebellions are often known as, you know, Nat Turner Rebellion or Gabriel Prosser or Denmark Vesey, and you want to look into this. And this is just named after some geography that is sort of meaningless today. You know, people in this region don't really call it the German coast. I mean, some would and some would know that, but largely that name has fallen out of history because this rebellion actually is not significantly acknowledged and remembered. And, you know, this rebellion, again, could have changed U.S. and world history and is even more than the capacity to change history. Here is a story with enslaved people organized and got together with, you know, more than 500 and had this bold vision of freedom. That's the story here. That's amazing. And people who care about humanity and care about the development of the world and how we got to where it is, I mean, it's both a real what-if question of what if it had succeeded, but it is also a question of, like, if we just want to know history, this is something that's really significant that should be known and all students should know, in part because these leaders were heroes. Instead of studying George Washington, a great enslaver, or Thomas Jefferson, a great enslaver, and when they talk about freedom, you should study people who were actually trying to get free from a system of enslavement, which was the foundation of the U.S. economy at the time.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with revolutionary artist Dred Scott about his latest piece of work called Slave Rebellion Reenactment. Yeah, you know, it's very heavy. I mean, just, you know, reading the things that you've put out in relation to this, that, you know, where you talk about why and what you're doing and why. And it's just, there's so much here to be learned that so many people won't, you know, just haven't learned because it's been actually hidden. It's been repressed history. You know, the whole idea that, you know, people got up there and that they had the motive for the rebellion wasn't just to go out and raise hell, but it was to end slavery and nothing less than that. That they wanted a whole different society. And that was a huge threat to the institution of slavery overall. And in a lot of ways, repeating that truth would be very, very, could be very, very dangerous today as well.
Well, I hope so in a certain sense. I mean, it's like, you know, this is a country that was founded on slavery and genocide, and it continues to be based on exploitation and oppression. And, you know, if I ran a society that was based upon the stolen wealth and suppression and violence and brutality, the stolen wealth from, you know, Africans and people of African descent, black people in this country, I sure wouldn't want people broadly to know that there was this, you know, major attempt at overthrowing and overturning that system. That might be inspiring and might have implications for today. And so, you know, this piece is actually about mining this past, and that's really important, and people should know that. And there's, you know, in conversations I've had with sort of youth, particularly those at historically black colleges, I get a sense of how important actually knowing more about the actual history of this past is. But it's also a piece about the present. I mean, a lot of my work looks at how the past both sets the stage for the present, but how it exists in the present in new form. And this history of, you know, rebellion and revolt and self-determination and agency of people trying to get free, to overthrow systems of oppression, it's something that people in the present should learn from. This is not a project about slavery. This is a project about freedom and emancipation. What would it mean if, you know, people actually drew inspiration from those people who identified was that the problem they were enslaved, that was their problem. The solution was to end slavery, not like lessen slavery's chains, not just get whipped Monday through Friday, not form a super PAC and try and, you know, write some legislation that says, you know, that modifies slavery. But they wanted to overthrow the system of enslavement. And people today can dream about, you know, changing some very fundamental things about this system. And I think that's where there's a lot of space and imagination get opened up by this project. And even on, you know, questions that, I mean, I just recently learned that a somewhat well-known family member of somebody who was killed by the police is getting on a plane to come out and participate in this reenactment. So for them to actually look at this history and look at it through a lens of trying to look at how people fought back, that's actually really important. And then, of course, some people, you know, may draw lessons that what we need here is a revolution. And I think that the possibility of that is opened up by this project.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to just return to this a little bit because it really strikes me as we're talking, you know, that this whole point about the motive for this rebellion being to end slavery and nothing less, that they wanted a whole different society. And that was a huge threat to the institution of slavery overall and to the sort of coming into power, U.S. whatever, you know, U.S. domination of the whole area. This was something that could not be allowed, it seems, in relation to what that slave rebellion could mean for the rest of the world, for the rest of the country.
Well, I mean, I think that's true, but then there's also sometimes things that can't be allowed happen. I mean, you know, if you know, Napoleon had his way, Haiti would have been drowned in blood. But the Haitian, you know, the people in Saint-Domingue that formed the nation of Haiti were successful. They beat the strongest power in the world at the time. And if this rebellion were successful, it certainly would have, you know, put not the final, but put a nail in the coffin of the system of slavery. But it's a question of, you know, how would the U.S. have responded if there were a free African republic right on its doorstep? Mm-hmm. America didn't initially say invade Mexico to rip off Texas. Texas ended up seceding from Mexico, and they did it so they could expand and preserve slavery. I mean, that's part of the irony, but the U.S. didn't have total freedom to do whatever it wanted. And so if this was successful, it's conceivable that the U.S. might have just had to tolerate a free republic on its doorstep. Again, I'm not a historian, and there would have been real reasons why they might have wanted to invade, but the country was not settled in as we know it today. And that's part of what I think is important about looking back at history. The past was not predetermined, and neither is the future. And so the aims and goals of this rebellion were something that could have actually really radically changed what was occurring. And as you say, this is what these people were aiming for, of overthrowing the system of slavery, was something that was irreconcilable with much of what the growing United States was trying to be. And so it would have been a very sharp rebuke and challenge that, you know, if it spread, I mean, would other enslaved people in other regions of the South said, hey, we should do that too and overthrow the system of enslavement? Would that have happened, or would it be something where the U.S. would have to act and try and reassert itself? And that's, I think, what is a bit, you know, it's unknown because, I mean, even at that point, the U.S. was also fighting the Spanish in West Florida, you know, which is, you know, modern day Mississippi and stuff. So that region was very unsettled even by the European powers. And then there were all sorts of different native peoples that, you know, lived there and were there long before the United States, the British, the French, and the Spanish were. And so, you know, it was a potentially volatile mix, which could have, you know, spun in lots of different directions, which is, and actually even on this question of native population, while this was predominantly a rebellion of enslaved people of African descent, there were native people who were some of which were enslaved and some of which were just in the region who joined the rebellion. And so it is, you know, this potential alliances of various oppressed people to, you know, take on colonial powers. You know, there's a lot of potential and excitement there.
You know, that's one of the things that I thought was really important about what you're doing here. And the fact that, you know, look, the rebels were tried and executed on the very plantations that they overthrew. Their heads were decapitated. Their heads were put on poles. There was a whole message sent out to people that was, you know, basically saying, don't even think about this. And yet the heroism of from what I've read in what you've been putting out, the heroism, the staunch belief in the need and the right for people to rebel against this horrifying situation and to establish, you know, their own living and their own ability to live and to flourish. And this is something that I think is really gets lost for people a lot of times, that this was not sort of like, you know, these people who had no real in sense of what they were doing. They were just like out to just like burn and pillage. They were actually people who were saying, we can no longer live like this. We refuse to live like this. And they stood up and they became a disciplined army of slaves, you know, and that was something that I think is really important. And that's what one of the things I thought was really important about what you're portraying in the piece that you're doing now, that you're portraying a disciplined army of slaves on a freedom march, actually.
Yeah. I mean, this question of discipline has a lot to do with how people see this period and whether it was just, again, people striking back. And let's be real. I mean, people who were enslaved on a sugar plantation, life expectancy was 7 years. They were literally working people to death because the commodity sugar was so valuable that they could basically work people and have them die and get more people to replace them. And so there was a strong incentive for individuals to run away, which happened a lot, to strike back as individuals, to run away with, you know, a few friends and form maroon colonies, and there were several maroon colonies in the area. But, you know, this was not that. This was something where people wanted to overturn the whole system of enslavement. And that's something that should, you know, really, really be known. And so there is a point of like, well, how were they trying to do that? We don't know a lot about this history. Because, you know, the only people who really, you know, tell it are enslavers. I mean, a lot of the record based on this that is based on is through these, you know, so-called tribunals or trials where they were basically torturing people saying, look, you know, we're going to kill you anyway. The real choice you have is whether we randomly kill a lot of your friends and family or whether you rat out all the people who participated so we can kill them too, and then we'll let some of your friends and family live. And so, you know, these were tribunals under a great deal of duress. And some people courageously stood up and said exactly what their aims and goals were. But others had, there were different stories, but a lot of this is, you know, assembled, you know, the knowledge of what people were, you know, attempting is based on, you know, sort of trial transcripts and a few other records. But the thing of how we know that they were a disciplined army is that the U.S. General Wade Hampton wrote to the governor, Governor Claiborne, and said there are 500 brigands in the field. They're marching in formation under flags. And so they didn't record what the flags looked like, but it was saying, look, we're fighting a disciplined army here. Now, this is people's war. It was an uprising. The enslaved could not form companies and stuff beforehand. They couldn't practice with the weapons that they were seizing in advance. But they knew, I mean, some of them were from regions of the world, regions of West Africa, where there were civil wars. So many of them, or some of them, probably had, you know, training in guerrilla tactics and civil warfare. Others of them had seen, you know, the militia for the planters train. And others of them might not have ever been in a battle or seen a battle, but knew they had to fight for freedom. So they grabbed, if you couldn't get a musket or a saber, you grabbed a machete. If you couldn't get a machete, you grabbed a rock or an axe or a hoe and farm implements. But it was discipline. They, you know, if the generals are saying, hey, these guys have, you know, are forming regiments or companies and they're marching under flags, I want to actually show that because it actually changes how modern day people look at that period and look at how black people organized with the possibility of getting free. Were people just like randomly striking back, which would have been just and righteous, or were they having, looking like they had a plan to get free and doing everything they could to execute that plan, even if the military strategy which they were going to employ would much more rely on guerrilla warfare and knowledge of the swamps and not wanting to get into a head-to-head battle and fight with the tactics that, you know, British colonial powers fought in. And actually, if you look at some of the history of the Haitian Revolution, the French were, you know, furious and bedeviled that the enslaved wouldn't just stand in a neat line waiting to be shot, that they had the audacity to, like, hide behind trees and things like that. So the military strategy that was employed from, you know, different armies working for different aims is something that, you know, will get expressed in this artwork, but it is something to take note of, that we want to challenge and change how people see sort of what black people in what is now America acted and behaved at that time.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slight Show, and we're talking today with revolutionary artist Dred Scott about his latest piece of work called Slave Rebellion Reenactment. You know, one of the things that you also talk about is you talk about this disciplined army of slaves on a freedom march, and that you're actually doing the actual march, the actual route that was taken by the slaves. And I kept thinking about that as I was reading this, because there's like that sense of, and I'm not trying to be like all weird about it, but there is this sense of like even those, the people, the feet of the people, the blood of the people in that same area that you're marching through, in that same route that you're marching through. And you have all of that going on. And then you have this message to the people where, you know, where the march will be that you're putting out. And I thought this was very heavy. I read that you had said that the rebels of 1811 would have been fighting for people like you, and basically posing to people the question of, so what are you going to do?
Yeah. Yeah. So first, let's give your listeners a bit of a sense of what this is, because we've been talking about the history, but we haven't so much talked about what the artwork is.
Mm-hmm.
And so Slave Rebellion Reenactment is going to reenact this rebellion, the largest rebellion of enslaved people in the history of the United States. And so we're going to have hundreds of reenactors in period costume with machetes and muskets and sickles and sabers. We're going to be marching for 26 miles in locations that were sugar plantations and are now oil refineries and pizza huts and grain elevators and gated communities and trailer parks and strip malls. It's exurban New Orleans. And we're going to be marching, chanting, on to New Orleans, freedom or death, we're going to end slavery, join us. There are going to be these beautiful flags flying. They aren't going to be U.S. flags. They're going to be flags that we imagine, you know, enslaved Africans might have made to rally their courage and to fight underneath. We'll draw on traditions that would have been popular for people in the regions at the time. And there will be singing. There will be banging rocks on machetes. As a drummer, who's a traditional African drummer who's providing some of the rhythm for us, said, this sounds like war. So it will be this beautiful procession. And largely it is a freedom march. There wasn't actually a lot of fighting in this rebellion until the rebellion was put down, and we're not reenacting that. We're not actually depicting the slaughter of a lot of black people by white people. We are actually interrupting the historic timeline. And when we get as far downriver as the rebel army got, we're going to get on buses and then go to a location in the city of New Orleans itself, which is now the old U.S. Mint, but in 1811 was Fort St. Charles. There was an advanced detachment of enslaved people in 1811 who were trying to seize that fort so that when people got out of the slave labor camps, also known as plantations, and got downriver, they would have enough weapons to seize the city. And so we're going to honor this sort of battalion that was trying to seize this fort. We're going to march past the old U.S. Mint. We're going to go through the French Quarter and end up in Congo Square. And when we get to Congo Square, we're going to flip from a military campaign to a cultural celebration. Congo Square and a few places like it are vital for preservation of the rhythms that became foundational to what we think of as American music. There were a couple places around the country, and Congo Square was one of them, where the rhythms, you know, where people were allowed to gather and dance and play in traditional ceremonies and rhythms and song that they did on back in the west coast of Africa. And so that laid the foundation for jazz, but then, of course, blues, rock and roll, rhythm and blues, funk, disco, hip-hop, bounce, trap, trance, none of that would exist if it weren't for Congo Square and places like it. And so there we're going to have in addition to lifting up the names of the rebels that you know, should be more known, we're going to have a musical celebration of all that is created by having this culture present in America. And so, you know, this is this amazing freedom march that you know, didn't have a lot of fighting. There is a little bit of fighting that's going to happen, and we're going to reenact a skirmish that happened with, so there'll be musket fire and horses charging around, and it'll be really, really cool. But the thing for people to understand is this is sort of, you know, black people moving in outdated French colonial 19th century clothing past grain elevators and oil refineries and pizza huts and gated communities. It'll be a clash between that past and the present, kind of. And in that space, I think a lot of people can really learn a lot and rethink both the history of enslavement, but also the history of people fighting for freedom.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the things, again, that really keeps striking me, I mean, I got to tell you, man, every time I read something about it and looked into what you had produced around it, I was really moved, and both by the history, but also by the what's being posed for people today. And the fact that when you brought people into this, it seems to have had a very big impact on people creating their own costumes, figuring out other ways to actually help push things forward, people coming to you and saying, look, I want to be a part of this. This is an extremely important development, I think, in the basic situation that we're living in today, because you know this, that, you know, you had 6 years of preparation and a whole community has gotten involved in this. And at the same time, they relied on what you have, but they've also developed these groups that you're talking about, figuring out ways that they can contribute. Yeah. And I think that's really important, both for people understanding what was the significance of what happened and what's the significance of what's happening today, what needs to happen today.
Yeah, so this thing of this being for people today, I mean, you mentioned something I said earlier about, you know, if people in the 1811 rebels were fighting for people like you. I mean, one of the things we're marching past is a steel refinery, steel plant that's been closed. So like 300 or 400 people were kicked out of work. I'd like to think that those people would view the spirit of 1811 as something they should be sort of taking up and fighting, not just for their job in a narrow sense, but actually to get to a world where people aren't just treated as you know, something that is valuable if they can produce profit for somebody else. And so, you know, people on that basis and others have actually been coming to this. There are people who participated in making costumes either for themselves or other people. A lot of people who, you know, the Army of the Enslaved is only black people and indigenous people, but lots of people of all ethnicities, including white people, have helped make the costumes. Our costume designer is white. And we encourage the people, particularly like the costume designer, to reach out beyond the traditional circles where she would have spontaneously gone to find other seamstresses and see if she could find some black seamstresses. And she did. And so it's been a really productive conversation for her. And then the people that are coming to volunteer and work with them collaboratively. And it's been really, really meaningful. I've been to a couple of these sewing circles. And people are talking about both the importance of the artwork, but also why it matters today, not just for something as sort of simple as ending racism or undoing racism, but for, you know, when people then start, you know, very quickly go to, well, the police just murdered a woman in her home in Fort Worth. You know, a woman is just sitting in her home. Somebody called the cops, foolishly, I might add, for a welfare call, and the cops show up and shoot the woman through her window. I mean, that's the world we're living in, and I think a lot of people are drawing connections between sort of history of enslavement and how people are treated today, and then hopefully the history of freedom fighters and how people need to get free today. And so I think that some of these relationships of people kind of walking in these shoes, both in the footsteps, because it is going on the locations that this rebellion actually happened, but more metaphorically in the shoes of people who really had nothing to lose, but could have, you know, continued to endure enslavement until they died in 7 years, but said, no, we need to get free. It's a long shot. We all may die doing it, but let's actually do something that has a chance of liberating us. Mm-hmm. And so those ideas, I think, are really meaningful to people. I was just at a rehearsal yesterday and last night, and we had some horse riders that are part of this, because we're going to have 20 horses as part of this with riders. And they, you know, wanted to participate for various reasons, but the more you talk with them, the more it actually resonates with how their lived experience is today and why it's meaningful for them to participate. And that's, and again, I mean, some of the young women who, when they get their hand on a machete, transform just these outdated clothing, which they liked, into, wait, we are really, you know, fighting for freedom. This is empowering, as they described it. And so it really transforms the degradation that people are subjected to on a daily basis in this society into something where people, you know, view themselves as part of trying to change the world in some really deep ways, I think.
Yeah. You know, I think one more thing I wanted to ask you, and this is, you know, look, you've talked about this already a little bit, but this is an art performance about freedom, resistance, and hope, and the importance of acknowledging the power that resides in reimagining your own destiny, as I think you put it. And this is this actually raises a whole thing that people need to understand, that there's a very important, very just necessary and neat and necessary and strong importance of this whole story being a what if story. That what, and you're starting to speak to this now, but I think it's really important that people understand this. This has everything to do, what you're putting forward here now has everything to do with what people are facing now and what they need to do. So let's talk about that.
Yeah. From its conception, this was thought of as a project that had a speculative nature that really did open up the question, both what if for the past, but what if for the present and future. And, you know, part of how I really started to understand that it resonated in people's bones was when I would speak at colleges, particularly historically black colleges and universities. And a couple of times, you know, students would come up to me after the talk, and the talk was generally, I also would have at least one or two historians, and one would typically talk about the history of slavery, and another would talk about the history of slave revolts, and specifically the revolt of 1811. And then I would talk about my artwork and this slave rebellion reenactment project. And students would come up and they would tell me that, you know, they didn't want to come. They were often assigned to it. They didn't want to come to something talking about slavery. And but then when they heard that there was, you know, all these examples, documented examples of a couple hundred, like 250 examples of 10 or more people, enslaved people, rebelling and having slave revolts in the United States, that was lifting a weight from them. And they wanted to know more. But the more that I talked with them, it became clear that they kind of felt, they would look at a situation that was like, well, man, why are black people, you know, why are there 1.1 million black people in prison? Why are we the ones that are poor? Why are the police shooting us down? Why are we the drug dealers? Why are our families broken, as they like to say, you know? And, you know, they really sort of felt a sense of shame, actually, about being black. But then when they would learn about this slave revolt, they suddenly realized that, wait, our ancestors weren't slaves. They were people that were enslaved. And that there was this tremendous joy and upliftment sense that they had when they heard about people fighting back and resisting. And that had everything to do with how they saw existing in the world in the present. Now, you know, these are kids 18 to 20 or 17 to, you know, 22 or something like that. And, you know, I don't know which ones of them, you know, participated in, say, demonstrations against police brutality or demonstrations or fighting to stop the climate crisis, or whether some of them had a loftier vision of fundamentally remaking the world through revolution. I don't know that, but I do know that they actually had this sense that they were not only were they not just something wrong with them based on being black, but really they could be the agents of change in a way that could be bigger than them, that it could really be, you know, something about changing the whole world. And that's really powerful, I think, for, you know, college students to suddenly have not only a sense, but in a certain sense, some of them got on a mission, including some wanting to participate in the reenactment itself, to, you know, form sort of the ideas, and then based on those ideas, some of the networks necessary to be part of, you know, really radically rethinking and then putting into place those thoughts of how the world could be different. And that's, you know, that's really, you know, inspiring and sort of what the work is about, even though, you know, I don't have it's an artwork. It doesn't have a prescribed ending or way people should change the world or even think about changing the world. But it does actually challenge people to sort of, in the present, think about the fact that in 1811, people identified, again, the problem is we're enslaved. The solution is to end slavery. How do we figure out the difficult and complicated things necessary to do that? And for us in the present, what are the analogies? What are the difficult things that we realize we're up against that often people recoil from and come up with things that are not really solutions to the problem they've identified, but things that they think are possible to achieve? So starting from, you know, a standpoint of identifying a problem and looking for a solution of what's actually necessary, even though you might not understand when you first identify the problem whether that necessary change is possible, but you have to go and figure out the work to do that. And that's what was done in 1811. And that's the spirit people, I hope, have now now, and you know, based upon engaging with this artwork, and including a lot of the reenactors engaging with it and participating in it over the course of months and in some cases years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can't wait to see what comes of it, man. I'm really, really looking forward to seeing what happens with this. I think it's a brilliant piece of work. It's a really necessary piece of work, and it's one that can actually have a major impact at a time when it's a major impact is really needed. So thank you very much, man.
Well, thank you. I can't wait to see it either. I've been working on it a long time, but the artwork doesn't exist until it exists. And so I'm looking forward to marching those 26 miles with hundreds of my closest new friends. And I hope that you stay tuned and look for the news reports and images and videos and, you know, tweet about it. You could, you know, go to our website to see more about it. You could see slave-revolt.com is our website. And on Instagram and Twitter, we're just at Slave Rebellion. But yeah, people should look out for this. It's going to be, I think it's going to be awesome. And if people could, you know, make sure that it's, you know, sunny and dry, I'd really appreciate it. If it was going rain or shine.
All right, man. And listen, I look forward to talking to you when it's all over too. I'm going to talk to you again next week, I think, to try and hear what actually has happened. So I really look forward
to it. Actually, one thing we didn't say, it's important. It's November 8th and 9th.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, fantastic.
All right,
Dred.
Take care, man.
Bye.
Okay, we've been talking with revolutionary artist Dred Scott. Now, Dred Scott makes revolutionary art to propel history forward. He first received national attention in 1989 when his art became the center of controversy over its transgressive use of the American flag while he was a student at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And President G.H.W. Bush called his art disgraceful. And the entire U.S. Senate denounced this work and outlawed it when they passed legislation to protect the flag. Well, on November 8th and 9th, 2019, hundreds of reenactors will retrace the path of the largest slave rebellion in U.S. history, embodying a story of resistance, freedom, and revolutionary action. And it's all brought to you by Dred Scott and his whole gang of cohorts.